All right, let's see here. Computer working properly here. All right, the next matter we'll take up is, in our merits docket, is Patrick Darnell Hill against the Commonwealth, Ms. Poe and Mr. Anderson. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
It's Pew.
Pew.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Pew, you have 15 minutes. Would you care to reserve any of that time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, well, glad to hear from you when you're ready.
May it please the court. Good morning. Here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Hill, the things that I would like to point out today for the court is that this case is one that deals with the lack of reasonable articulable suspicion. As the court is very aware, in Terry v. Ohio, an officer may conduct a brief investigatory stop when he has reasonable articulable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. My argument is that in this case, there was not such. This is actually a case in which the officer, specifically Detective Hunter, stated that he had, in essence, a hunch that the defendant was committing a crime. The defendant's vehicle was parked against a fence. Both officers, Detective and Hunter, stated that they did not see anything illegal with the car. They did not suspect anything illegal with the car. They were, in essence, approaching.
I thought the officers testified to the effect that they suspected, whether it was a hunch or otherwise, they suspected that because this area was had some narcotic sales taking place in it, that perhaps your client was either a buyer or a seller.
Correct, Your Honor. I believe Officer, Detective Hunter, specific words that he was just investigating, that he thought that because it was a high crime, high drug area, but as the court is aware, mere presence in a high crime, high drug area is not sufficient. The court has to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Counsel, could you tell me, where do you think that the consensual encounter stopped and the seizure began?
I think that it was consensual when the officers first approached the vehicle. It is my contention that when the officer started telling my client, show your hands repeatedly, and my client was continuing to not obey that, I believe that is when the consensual encounter then became a seizure.
How could be a seizure if he hasn't submitted to any authority by the police at that point? Well, it seems to me at best, the seizure might be when they pulled him out of the car.
That is true, Your Honor.
Or does it make any difference, really, from the standpoint of the legal analysis? Does it really matter if he was seized when they pulled him out of the car or at some point earlier? I mean, at the moment of seizure, there needs to be either probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion, doesn't there?
Correct. There needs to be probable cause or reasonable suspicion at the moment of seizure. And so I would actually say that I misspoke, that the seizure would be when he was actually taken out of the car. That at the time when they were still trying to talk to him or get him to show them the hands, I would say that that was still consensual. However, I don't believe my client felt that he could leave at that time, even though no evidence was presented as to such. I would also
ask. But you're not suggesting that your client, when he refused to put his hands up, you're not suggesting that your client gave in to any kind of seizure at that point?
No, I would not say that. No. I would also ask the court to note that the fact that my client was not responding, that once again was not enough for the officers then to reach in, grab him by the arm, and remove him from the vehicle. He was not consenting to their
investigation. What about the cases that talk about safety concern? Officer safety.
I think that the officers can ask him questions, but you're correct. There are many cases that address officer safety, and an officer can question an individual with respect to things and can conduct the stop and frisk or the pat down for officer safety.
Well, that all requires reasonable suspicion, doesn't it?
Correct. And my argument is that they never got there. What I also want the court to note is that the officers never even identified themselves or what they were doing. I think that they're required to do so. Yes, they
why,
had on,
why if they're in uniform or
they had on vests. They weren't in uniform. So I would just ask the court to note that. They were not in a marked
vehicle. At what point do they, I mean, if it's obvious, if it would, and maybe that's a fact finder's conclusion. We weren't there, but
I understand.
But and I'm not necessarily familiar with every item of wardrobe that the police department might wear, but I've seen some police vests in my time, and they're pretty obviously marked police. And if you're wearing one, I guess there's at least a, it raises at least the point that you might be a police officer.
I think that, yes, you're right. I think that the officer, I wasn't there either. I did not try the case or do the motion to suppress. What I want the court to know is that, yes, they did have on attire that did indicate they were police. However, they never stated what they were doing there. They never gave him any inkling as to why they were approaching him. And I think that they are required to do that. They basically walked on the car and said, show us your hands, show us your hands, show us your hands, repeatedly. So I don't think that that is enough for reasonable articulable suspicion. I think that, yes, the officers do have the right to question him. However, they never even got to a
question. You can appreciate that a police officer might be a little bit concerned if they're, whether they have the right to do it or not, if they're approaching someone to question them about something and they keep moving their hands out of sight in a high crime area. Now, whether that's reasonable suspicion or whether they're entitled to do anything about it is maybe a different question. But I can certainly appreciate why a police officer might be concerned if someone they're about to talk to keeps, you know, moving their hands, you know, below the level where he can see what they're doing.
And I can definitely appreciate the concern. Yes, the officers have a right to be concerned for their safety. I think what the issue is that when they approached that vehicle, they were merely approaching the vehicle because it was in a high crime, high drug area. They had a hunch. I believe one officer said he was just investigating, but they did not see anything wrong with the car.
They can do that as part of a consensual encounter, can't they?
They can. I think that they can. Yes, I would concur.
Well, I know Mr. Anderson is going to disagree with you, but I gather that you don't really have a problem with anything that was done from a legal standpoint up until your client was physically removed from the vehicle. Is that correct?
That would be correct. My issue was the fact that he was removed, how he was removed, and at that point, I believe it's my contention that they did not meet the standard.
Okay.
And that's required. And I feel that they violated his rights.
All right.
Thank you.
We've got a lot of time left in rebuttal then, eight and a half minutes.
Yeah.
Morning, Mr. Anderson. Nice of you to join us.
Good morning. May it please the court. I don't have a whole lot to say beyond what's in my brief, although I must say counsel's last statement that she didn't really have any legal challenge until he was removed from the car. I'm not really sure what that leaves the defendant. But
well, let me ask you about it then. If that's the point, well, first of all, would you agree that that's the point at which he sees is what he's taken
right
out of the car?
When he's physically taken out of the car, well, they finally were able to get him under control and they handcuff him. He certainly sees.
Would you agree that at the moment of seizure, the police need either probable cause to seize him and to conduct a search, as they ultimately did, or at least reasonable suspicion?
I would agree with that, and I think that there's plainly reasonable articulable suspicion.
What is it beyond just the high crime area?
Well, counsel's left
city
out.
Of course
it's axiomatic that you have to look at the entire set of facts, and counsel's left out several important facts that bear upon an assessment of the validity of any Terry stop. First, when they were, the two officers, it was an unmarked vehicle, but they indicated in their testimony they had on police vests and apparently police badges, apparently two distinct police identification items. In any event, when they first saw the defendant parked alone in his car in a high crime area where both officers, their experience was such that drug deals had occurred right in that area, which of course is part of the mix for what the court considers. When they first came across him, they said he was just watching. He wasn't moving around. They make a U-turn and they come back in the vicinity of his car. They're looking at him for about a minute, and now they describe him as, quote, looking up and down, and he was constantly doing a bunch of movement inside of the vehicle. So that's what they see before they ever take a step towards him. They then, after about a minute of watching this, they approach his car, which they had every right to do. I cited a case from this court saying that if the police walk up to a parked car, that's...
Nobody's challenging that.
Okay. Well, but it still leads up to the ultimate conclusion. So they come to his, they approach his car, he spots them, there's not an ambush, much as in the Port case that this court recently decided, also out of Portsmouth. He knows that they're coming because he looks in their direction. And what he does at that point is very revealing. According to them, he, quote, immediately went towards the back of the car. He put his left hand on the steering wheel and with his right hand hunched over behind the driver's seat and into the back seat with his right hand. His actions were sufficiently alarming that one of the officers, before they ever tried to get in the car, said, in so many words, I think or I'm afraid you have a firearm. His actions thereafter certainly didn't alleviate that concern. He continued. There were multiple, at least 10, according to one of the officers.
Well, I think we're getting ahead of the game here, Mr. Anderson. Tell me where I'm off the rails here. It seems to me you're absolutely correct. The police have, there's no problem with them approaching a vehicle.
Right.
They don't need anything to do that.
Correct.
And, but it seems to me neither is an individual required to, quote, show their hands upon request if they don't want to, if the police haven't any reason to detain them.
Well, two things in response, Your Honor. One, the number of times it occurred here easily exceeded those in Jones and Beasley. Jones and Beasley clearly relied heavily so on the continuing failure of the person in the car, whether it be a driver or a passenger, not to comply with the order and not to show their hands. There's no question that those cases heavily rely upon that, but it's not simply...
How does that bear on a reasonable suspicion analysis?
Well,
I mean, we talk about reasonable suspicion, but it's reasonable suspicion to believe criminal activity is afoot.
But it wasn't simply the failure to show his hands. He continued to dig back. He held the steering wheel with his left arm, continued to dig back behind him with his right arm. And again,
That goes to the potential weapon issue and safety, but...
Well, you could have...
I think Judge Humphrey's point is, where's the reasonable suspicion that justifies removing him from the car?
Well, they're for all sorts of reasons. They're afraid he's trying to get a gun, which bears upon officer safety. They're afraid that maybe he's trying to grab the drugs. All I can tell Your Honors is that Jones and Beasley involved substantially similar facts and rejected substantially similar arguments.
What's not so similar, though, is the officer here stating that basically he was acting on a hunch, which, as you know, is a verboten basis for doing anything to Terry.
Well, as Your Honor himself indicated in counsel's initial argument, you have the right. I submit that whether they had a hunch or not is, for constitutional purposes, irrelevant. What they had the right to go up to him under any and all circumstances in a public setting and attempt to speak with him.
Absolutely. But they don't have a right to drag him out of a car unless they have at least reasonable suspicion he's committing a crime.
I submit that they had it in spades. I don't see any way that...
Reasonable suspicion of what? What can you point to in this record that suggests that he was perhaps committing a crime?
He may have had a concealed weapon, for example, which would pose a danger to them. He may have had drugs, and in fact, he did.
He certainly may have, but that's always going to be the case. The question is, what facts and circumstances did these officers actually articulate that suggests that criminal activity is afoot? That's the question it seems to me you have to answer.
Well, they don't have to articulate it at a hearing. They're either there or they're not. Their testimony showed his repeated actions in attempting to dig behind him in a way that, again, they were sufficiently alarmed that they said before they even tried to get in the car, I'm afraid or I think you may have a gun. I don't look at you.
Here, Detective Hunter testified, and I'm quoting from page 28 of the joint appendix. When we approached the vehicle beside our police unit, the subject looked up and then looked down, and then finally went down. So as we got out of the vehicle and approached on foot, that's when the subject placed his left hand on the steering wheel and turned his whole entire back and head away from us and began digging down between the driver's seat. And then shortly after, the hunter basically agreed they were operating on a hunch. And then he was asked what crime he believed Hill was committing. And his response was just, quote, just investigating. And when he asked what he was investigating, his reply was, could have been, narcotics.
That was his description of his mindset at the time they began to walk to the car. When they walked to the car, things changed 180 degrees solely as a result of the defendant's actions. They never even had the opportunity to engage him in what potentially would be...
Wasn't his only action his refusal to put his hands where they could see him?
Again, Your Honor, that's part of it. That's not all of it. He immediately began to dig behind him.
Well, that's already been testified to by Hunter here. You said that everything changed after that.
Everything did change, because when they went up to him, they weren't sure exactly what the situation was. I would note in the Port case, when they approached, which very similar facts, except there at least the defendant initially cooperated, which you never had in this case. You never had, as you did in Beasley, an initial brief compliance.
Is being parked in a high crime area enough reasonable suspicion?
I doubt it, but that's far from what we have here. I think that their testimony makes clear, again, it has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth on appeal. When they went to him, they had some suspicion, and again, under the Fourth Amendment, I would say, so what? Whether they had a hunch or not, they had the right to approach his car. They never got the chance to begin any potential consensual conversation, because the moment they approached him and he saw them, he reacted in a highly suspicious manner, not only failing to comply with numerous...
What obligation did he have to comply with the officers? What legal obligation did he have to comply with the officers? Put your hands where we can see him.
Well, I think that question could have been posed in Jones and Beasley. That's not the governing question or the governing consideration. The consideration is what happened.
So failure to obey a police officer and the request of a police officer equates to reasonable suspicion. Is that your position?
It can be. Can be. But again, you have to, Your Honor, it is...
How can doing anything that you're permitted to do under the law ever be suspicion of a crime?
Your Honor, it is fundamental. You have to look at the facts in their entirety in a Fourth Amendment case. Of all the amendments, that would be about at the top of the list. You cannot just isolate, well, he had literally the right to do this. He had literally the right not to comply.
And I don't Mr. Anderson, I'm not trying to beat you up here. I understand. You're absolutely correct in what the Fourth Amendment permits. Totality of the circumstances. And is what the police officers are doing reasonable under those circumstances?
I think they are patently reasonable. Patently reasonable. Again, it's not simply a matter of refusing to comply with the repeated request to show his hands. It's the continuing, never-ending attempt to grab behind him. If that's not a reasonable, articulable suspicion...
If I'm walking down the street and a police officer says, stop where you are, I want to talk to you, and I keep on walking, and he says, I want to talk to you, stop, I'm telling you to stop right where you are, and I again ignore him and keep on walking, is that reasonable suspicion for him?
It may not be. It's a much weaker case for the Commonwealth than what we have here.
What if it's in a high crime area of Portsmouth?
It's less weak, but either way, it's...
What if the officer says, I can't see your hands, turn around, and I don't?
Well, then you're inching up further and further.
Well,
to
when
the
do
facts
I cross
that we
the
have
line
here.
Then? What do I have to do to cross the line?
Well, I don't
line?
Think that there's an absolute red line. That's why we have a zillion Fourth Circuit appeals, because there is no red line. You take the facts of each case as you find it. Again, I submit this with the strongest belief in its correctness, that there is no way this court can reverse this case consistent with Jones and Beasley and Pork. I would like to know how you could have a reversal here where the court says, consistent with those three cases, there was no reasonable articulable suspicion here. I don't know if I have any additional time, but...
4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. Again, you have to look at the full panoply of facts here.
Is the search here based on the on what, arrest or Terry Frisk or what? What's the Commonwealth position there?
I don't know if they articulated, but I think it, legally speaking, it could be based on any of them. He was arrested at that point. They certainly have the right to search the car.
He was arrested. What was the probable cause for it?
Well, I don't know I don't think the court reached the issue of probable cause, but I think even if it's reasonable articulable suspicion, they have the right.
What case says you can search incident to reasonable articulable suspicion?
No, but they certainly have the right to undertake any action to make sure that their lives are not in danger.
So it's really the officer's safety that you're relying on.
That's heavily what I'm relying upon. I mean, the failure to show the hands obviously goes to safety, but the continuing, non-ending attempt to grab behind him, which, again, the officer at the moment there, not here in Norfolk X number of months later, at the moment it was happening, the officer expressed concern that this man had a gun. He never at that point said, wait a minute, you got that wrong, here's my hands, you know, nothing like that. He continued in the face of that officer's statement to do what he did. The only reason it stopped was that They used enough force, even though he, according to one of the detectives, was grabbing the steering wheel so strongly they couldn't do it easily. They finally used enough force to wrest his arm off the steering wheel and get him under control. It was very easy for him to alleviate their concerns when they said, "I'm afraid you have a gun." To put it mildly, that's not what he did. I'd ask the court to affirm.
Counsel?
Just briefly in rebuttal, counsel keeps stressing that this case is not analogous to Jones. What I want the court to note is in Jones, that was a case in which was in a high crime, high drug area where officers had been known to observe drug transactions. Also in Jones, in that case, the defendant was told to stop by the officer but continued to walk at a brisk pace. His behavior was defined as nervous, evasive behavior. I would say that that is analogous to my client constantly reaching and not showing his hands. The court ruled that, specifically with Jones, that just because of his refusal to heed the officer's request to stop, that's not enough, once again, for the seizure. Citizens, it's been quoted, the court has held that citizens who are not under arrest or otherwise detained have every right to refuse or ignore requests from law enforcement officers. Here, in my case, my client, in essence, he refused. He refused until the officer seized him, grabbed his hand, and pulled him out of the car. And so that would be the last thing that I'd like to point out to the court.
Counsel, can you distinguish Pork and Beasley for this court? Distinguish that from the facts in your case, both of those cases?
Your Honor, I would say with respect to Pork, and I apologize, I'm just trying to formulate. I would say,
I mean, you recognize we're bound by
opinions. I understand, yes, Your Honor.
So it's helpful if...
And so I actually looked at Pork and Beasley this morning for points to pull out. And
don't worry, we've all been in your shoes.
I struggled trying to find them this morning, so I would say no, I do not have any to point out.
So. Okay, thank you.
Yes,
thank you. All right, then, we'll come down and greet counsel and then take up the next case.
All right.